Good morning. Is there any such thing as truth? We're not speaking of so-called existential truth, that which may be true for one person but not for another, or that which may be true in one situation but not in another. We're talking about real truth, objective truth, absolute truth. Is there such a thing as real, objective, absolute truth? According to many sources in today's world, the answer to the above question would be no. A professor in a state university once stated, "There's no such thing as absolute truth." A Christian student timidly raised his hand and asked, "Are you absolutely sure?" The professor's thesis collapsed from its own weight. The concept of truth in religious matters is becoming more and more elusive. If one believes once saved, always saved, that's truth for him. If one believes that to stay saved, he must be faithful unto death, that's truth for him. If one accepts sprinkling for baptism, it is either true for that individual or it doesn't really matter. If another practices immersion, he's entitled to his truth. Provided, of course, he does not insist it upon some others. This is a sad state of affairs in today's religious world. In America, we've become champions of individualism, the idea that every individual chooses for himself what is right, with no higher authority than himself, as in ancient Israel, where every man did that which was right in his own eyes, Judges 21:25. As Solomon said, every way of a man is right in his own eyes, Proverbs 21:2. There are several prominent philosophies that deny the application of any standard of objective truth. Consider the following examples. Number 1, situation ethics. Situation ethics, also known as the new morality, is associated particularly with the name of Joseph Fletcher. It holds that there are no moral absolutes. Fletcher says, for the situationist, there are no rules, none at all. The one guiding principle is love. What does that mean? Well, Erwin Lutzer has pointed out where this leads to. Sex relations outside of marriage are not intrinsically wrong. The only intrinsic evil becomes the lack of love. Adultery, lying, and murder are not always wrong, and in some situations they may be loving acts. Now, this system of belief offers no real solutions for those who are facing moral or ethical dilemmas. Why? Because everyone may have a different opinion of what is loving or unloving in a given situation. Thus, every individual becomes a law unto himself. Then there's postmodernism. Post means after, and postmodernism is a philosophy that has come into being after modernism. Modernism, as most of us know, was exceedingly rationalistic. Miracles could not be true because they could not be proved in the laboratory. Everything had to be subjected to scientific proof. Postmodernism is now the predominant theory. It has supplanted modernism, even though some modernistic influences remain. But where modernism emphasized reason, postmodernism largely rejects reason and logic. It promises instead a reliance on intuition and feeling. The postmodernist says, "How do I know Jesus lives? He lives within my heart." The emphasis is upon a mystic experience, not upon evidence or logical deduction. In fact, the cardinal sin of postmodernism is for one to claim that he knows the truth. According to postmodernism, logic and reason are tainted by one's cultural background and are therefore unreliable. Since intuition and feeling will vary according to the individual, there can be no such thing as objective, absolute truth. Perhaps this is why one study of postmodernism has been entitled The Death of Truth. Then we have doctrinal relativism. To say the truth is relative is another way to state that truth is not absolute. Efforts are made today to justify almost every doctrinal position that men espouse. An air of false toleration pervades our society. We dare not criticize. We must be politically correct, even in religion. Thus, one speaker refers to Ephesians 4 as a doctrinal platform for unity. He calls it a core minimum of truth. That sounds very definitive. A core minimum of truth that cannot be diminished. Therefore, it is essential, crucial, and absolute. But wait, although we must believe in one God as part of that doctrinal minimum, if you don't parse it in Trinitarian terms as I do, I don't think that disallows you as a Christian. So here's the doctrinal minimum. The seven ones of Ephesians 4, including one God, but we do not want to exclude anyone. Therefore, you can be Trinitarian or Unitarian, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, or Jesus only. All are welcomed and all are included. The same speaker says that being a Christian is more important than whether you're a Church of Christ or you're a Presbyterian. Newspaper columnist Tom Eric, an Episcopal priest, states this, The truth about homosexuality might lie in a few scattered verses or in the tendency of Jesus to embrace all persons and to ignore sexuality issues. Eric suggests that we can either take specific verses in the Bible on homosexuality, or we can draw conclusions from what we observe in the tendency of Jesus to ignore sexuality issues. References to homosexuality as abomination, Leviticus 18:22, as sin, Isaiah 3:9, and lust, Romans 1:27, are overcome by the fact that Jesus embraced all persons. After all, these are only a few scattered verses, as opposed to our own subjective observations of the tendency of Jesus to overlook such matters. This sort of relativism ignores the objective statements of absolute truth in preference for man's own subjective feelings and tendencies. Friends, truth is attainable. Jesus said, "And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free," John 8:32. Truth is understandable. "Wherefore, be ye not unwise, but understanding what the will of the Lord is," Ephesians 5:17. Truth is identifiable. In his prayer to the Father, Jesus said, "Sanctify them through thy truth, for thy word is truth," John 17:17. Truth is consistent. It is impossible for God to lie, Hebrews 6:18, Titus 1:2. The thought, homosexuality is wrong, but it is right. Baptism is sprinkling, but it is immersion only. Man cannot fall, but he must take heed lest he fall, would suggest that God speaks out of both sides of his mouth. We know that one's character is associated with his word. It is an assault on the character of God to contend that truth is whatever one wants it to be. "Woe unto them that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter," Isaiah 5:20. There are several types of truthful statements in the Bible. There are historical statements. David was king over Israel, 2 Samuel 5:4. Jesus was born in Bethlehem, Matthew 2:1. Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek, Genesis 14:20. These historical chronicles are not relative. They are either accurate or they're not. All of us recognize the essence of truth when historical statements are involved. There are factual statements. Jesus fed the multitude with 5 loaves and 2 fishes, Mark 6:38. Peter spoke to the multitude at the third hour of the day, Acts 2:15. These are statements of fact, and they are either true or false. It is ludicrous to suppose that these statements do not say what they say. Number 3, there are theological statements. Jesus Christ is the Son of God, Matthew 16:16. Jesus shed his blood for the forgiveness of men's sins, Matthew 26:28. The church was purchased by the shedding of the blood of Christ, Acts 20:28. Jesus was born of a virgin, Matthew 1:18-25. Theological statements are declarations of spiritual truth. One may believe or disbelieve these great theological principles, but in the very nature of the case, there cannot be no vagueness regarding them. If Jesus was born of a virgin, then his birth was spatial and miraculous. He was not born according to the natural process of human conception and birth. Number 4, there's doctrinal statements. "He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved," Mark 16:16. "There is one body," Ephesians 4:4. "Religious division is carnal," 1 Corinthians 1:10 and 1 Corinthians 3:3. Again, in the very nature of truth, these statements are of such character that we must either accept them or reject them. Then finally, there's logical statements. In 1 Corinthians 15:12-20, the Apostle Paul reasons regarding the resurrection by a series of if-then statements. If the premise is true, then the conclusion follows. For instance, "But if there be no resurrection of the dead, then is Christ not risen," verse 13. This manifests that truth is conveyed not only by direct statements, but also by logical deductions. Truth is indeed objective and absolute. It is strange that most religious teachers can recognize this principle in historical statements or factual declarations. But when they come to theological teaching or doctrinal truth, however, their faculties falter. If there is such truth, and if truth is objective, absolute, and knowable, then it follows that there is also error. Error is a deviation from or a contradiction of that which is truth. If it is truth that there are three persons in the Godhead, then it is error that there is only one person in the Godhead. If it is truth that one must remain faithful in order to be saved, then it is error to teach once saved, always saved. If it is truth that homosexual behavior is sin, then it is error to teach that one may choose his sexual orientation. The effort in our day to make every doctrine and every practice acceptable simply does not correspond to the nature of truth. Friends, we must study the Scriptures in order to know and understand the truth. Paul encourages Timothy to study to show himself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. Remember that the ancient Bereans received the word with all readiness of mind and searched the Scriptures daily whether those things were so. Acts 17, verse 11. Let us imitate their example. Until next week, may God bless and keep you.